Hey, everybody, welcome to the show. Before we get to my guest this week, I'm going to be on the road this week. I'm heading to Plano, Texas at the House of Comedy, August 18th to the 20th. That's Thursday to Saturday. So if you're in the area, come on out. And then following week, August 25th to the 27th, I'm going to be at the House of Comedy in Phoenix, Arizona. And yes, it's the dead of summer. So I'm, and then after that, I'm going to go to the center of the earth because I want to cool off from being in Plano and Arizona. I go to the hottest spots at the worst time of the year. Anyway, now the great clubs, House of Comedy, both places, Plano, Texas, and Phoenix, Arizona. Hope you can make it out. One last thing. Interesting week. I always like to tell you a little bit of what's going on with me. On the road, had a big corporate show to do, and the night before, had a kidney stone attack on Amtrak and ended up in the hospital in D.C. and had to pass kidney stone, which was the most excruciating pain I have ever felt. And the only thing worse than the pain was dealing with the people in the emergency room who could have cared less that I was in pain. I was on the floor, writhing in pain on the floor. And the response, I said, look, I'm not trying to jump the line here. I'm really, most of the people, by the way, in the emergency room are using the emergency room as like their urgent care facility. They're kind of a little sick, but it's not an emergency because I could tell because people are like sitting there looking at their phones and knitting and whatever. And when you're knitting, you're not that sick. Okay. So I'm screaming, please, can you let me in? And the woman said to me, can you get a nurse to see me, a doctor, please, please. And the woman said to me, I'm quoting now, well, you're not dying. All right. Well, that's our standard now. You're not dying. And by the way, if you haven't passed a kidney stone, what I suggest you do is swallow a spiked ball and then pass that. And that's not as bad as a kidney stone. All right. My guest this week, Mike Figliola, a really terrific author with a new book out that it's a really beautifully written book. It's set in Queens, and we're going to get into the whole book and how he wrote it and what motivated him in his process. But it's a really terrific book and a terrific author that this guy's really making a big splash, and I wanted you to know about him and know about the book. So enjoy Mike, avoid hospitals, and try swallowing a ball with spikes and see what happens. Just, you know, for fun, like if you're bored on a Saturday night. All right. Enjoy Mike. Hey, everybody. Welcome to the show. My guest this week, old friend, dear friend, they worked together before. He is a reporter, producer, and writer in local and national news. He's a terrific, terrific poet who's written hundreds of poems. He calls New York City his home, specifically Queens. He's got a terrific new book out, The Slow Midnight on Cypress Avenue. Please welcome my pal and a terrific author, Mike Figliola. How you doing, man?
Excellent, Paul. Hey, thanks so much for having me. Really excited to be here with you.
Yeah. So this book that you wrote is taps into your childhood growing up in Cypress Avenue in Queens. And it's a snapshot. It's a day in the life, which I really liked and I thought was cool. And it's set on a specific day. And, you know, you said something really interesting about it. You said this is not just a Queen story. It's palatable across any place you live. It's a neighborhood book. And that can mean a lot of different things. But for you, what does it mean?
Yeah, so you hit the nail right on the head. The book is a neighborhood book about neighborhood people. I grew up in a very blue-collar home. My father was a cop. My mom was a homemaker, but she worked at home. My grandfather was a sailor. You know, I have, you know, and I really felt like those are the folks I wanted to write about and highlight in my book. You know, Cypress Avenue, which I didn't grow up on Cypress Avenue. My family all did, and I visited there a lot, spent a lot of time there as my youth. It's a thoroughfare that runs and straddles the border of Queens and Brooklyn. And there's a lot of different folks there. You know, there's a lot of regular people, bus drivers, bakers, the candlestick maker, all of those people work there, the delis, the bodegas. And I found those people the most fascinating. And growing up, there was always these wild characters on the street. Everybody had a story, and I wanted to highlight them. But to answer your question, those people could live in St. Louis, or they could live in L.A. They could live out in the sticks. It's all about neighborhood people and their relationships with each other. These people are a little more on the seedier side. They've seen better times. The whole avenue's seen better times, But somehow Cypress Avenue was still home. And I grew up in a way where we used to hang out on stoops at night. You know, stoop is for a Queens guy or Brooklyn guy, New York guy, stoop is the stairs that lead up to your apartment door or your home door. We used to sit out there and talk all night, you know, and that I remember growing up the most, being outside there. But that could be a porch in Pennsylvania. You know, it doesn't matter where you are. They're your neighbors. They're the people, you know. And that's how I feel like, even though it's Cypress Avenue, it could be Main Street anywhere.
Yeah, that's exactly how I grew up. I grew up in a tenement house in Providence, Rhode Island. And I grew up in a place called Charles Street. And this book reminds me, it's exactly the way we grew up. There were a lot of Italians, it was a predominantly blue collar across the board. But my uncle was a barber. But then there was some white collar. My other uncle was a dentist. Excuse me. And you know, there was the bus driver and all of that. You wrote this in a way. You know, you do it. You're writing it. You use vignettes, and to me, the substance drove the form, right? Because it's all about telling these people's stories. And sometimes that's hard to do in a traditional narrative, right? And was that the main reason you did vignettes as opposed to sort of a, you know, more traditional full-length narrative kind of thing?
Yeah, I thought it gave the characters all their own voices and different perspectives and different ways to view it. A few of them are in first-person narrative. And some of them are from like an omniscient narrative, just talking about the characters. So I'll be honest too, I really love Quentin Tarantino's Pulp Fiction. And I love how he did that movie and broke it up into these narratives that made this one big story.
Yeah.
And I thought it'd be interesting to jump into these people's lives on the avenue and a day in their life, but from different vantage points. It's still linear in terms of like the time frame, but you're jumping in, a guy's coming back from fishing all day and he's sort of downtrodden and misses his mother and longs for yesteryear. And it goes into that portion of how the neighborhood's changed for him. And then there's this other narrative of this old guy who's locked up in an apartment. He's a kind of a miserly, curmudgeon, old drunk who's sitting around. And this young girl visits him every day because she has no family. And they've somehow formed this weird bond together where, not sexual or anything like that, you know, they're just hanging out.
Right.
To me, I just wanted to do it in the vignette form because it gave these little small stories into their lives and opened it up for just interpretation or even just a different vantage point. So I figured if you wrote a linear book, you hear the same guy talking about the same thing over and over, you're not going to get the real flavor of all these different people.
Yeah.
That's why I like, and like I said, Pulp Fiction too. I love the way he crafted that movie, and I thought it'd be great to do that in a book form.
Yeah. I know that you said these are loosely based on characters from the neighborhood, but you've embellished. And I know you said, you know, writing some of these characters, you know, could be, for lack of a better term, a little challenging, like particularly having to write, like, you know, you said, the challenge for me was writing in Desi and Father John White. I don't want to give too much away, but writing from a voice of a young Puerto Rican girl, really, to me, you've always come off like there was a Puerto Rican femininity to you now, and a Southern minister. Because when we would, you know, work together a little bit, I'm like, I sense he's Puerto Rican now. But how do you do that? Because, you know, when I write, you know, as a comedian or if I'm writing something, it's generally for myself or a project that I'm going to be in. Mm. How do you put yourself into that mode? You know, you talked about Ben Zogby and Earl the Fisherman, and there were two other characters that came a little easier for you. How do you do a 12-year-old Puerto Rican girl?
Yeah, well, I had to write two. There's another scene of these Lolly and Lorraine, who happen to be two of my mom. My mom's middle name is Lorraine, and she had a best friend Lolly growing up. So I tried to incorporate these little things into the book. But they're these young girls who end up running away from Cypress Avenue, trying to leave it. And I had to write from what would it be like to be two young girls in high school trying to leave their lives and disappear into the night. I guess I come from a really large, I have a large Italian family and a large Irish family. So I drink and eat well, right? I mean, that's basically my life.
Exactly. A lot of yelling,
you know, the people don't talk to each other for a couple months and then we're all back at Sunday dinner and that kind of stuff.
Right.
But what I did was too, on top of having this large family to draw off of, and I mean, old age, I have 20 first cousins on my mother's side. I mean, this is real Irish shit we're talking about here, Paul. But I went down to Cypress Avenue and I spent time down there taking notes, speaking with people, getting
really
drunk with locals, sitting on the stoops, hanging out in the bodegas, going to a diner and listening. And all of those people in my book are made up of all of those folks that I bumped into and took notes about and listened to. And I really wanted to write honestly about the forgotten, the person that you wouldn't think twice about. You don't think about the guy that's pushing the ice cream, the ice cart down the street or the vegetable stand. I just love, they see it all, those people, and they're living hand to mouth. And so,
and they also support society in a way that's subtle, but important, right? Like, so if you started, it's like, It's a Wonderful Life, right? Like if you start eliminating those people, right? Those neighborhoods, every neighborhood, even, you know, the Upper East Side of Manhattan likes the local market, likes the person in the supermarket that's at that. There's a familiarity that I think is important to people's emotional well-being and mental well-being. Not just a commonality, which is one of the themes in the book, but also a sense of like, my life is in the right place and normal when there's that, those are recurring characters in your real life.
And you know, too, when you think of New York and people set the tone or the story or the setting, everyone writes about Broadway, you know, everyone writes about Times Square or Arthur Avenue and the
Wall
Bronx.
Street there.
Wall Street. And I wanted to write about Cypress Avenue because I think, you know, that's, you should check it out. I mean, you should go down there and walk around. Yeah, you maybe wear a bulletproof vest or something, but I mean, I would still go down there. And
no, but just say that they know you. I know Mikey. Come on.
Mikey. They may shoot at you even more. But,
they used to call me Paulie. I don't know if they called me Mikey, but they called me Paulie.
They call me Fig. I mean, that's what I get.
Oh, is that right? Fig. That's how I should.
All the last name became Fig. Yeah.
And when, you know, there was something else that really struck me as this idea of moving away. Mm. I got chills when I read this. It says, everyone there wanted to move away and stay forever at the same time. Mm. This is you. It was those same streets and buildings that fostered it all. It's in that dissonance, which is a big theme here, that attracted me to bring to life the people in place of Cypress Avenue. And that is exactly... So, you know, we joke, like some people just don't move from out of Rhode Island. Like Rhode Island is the smallest state in the union, right? So like if, you know, you live in New York, right? You know, used to traffic, whatever. But in Rhode Island, like they're so fucking spoiled. Like if you go, I talked to my sister, you're like, I had traffic. I was like 10 minutes. I was in traffic for 10 minutes. Like, you know, you can get from one state to the other in an hour, right? So there's a small town quality to it, even though it's a pretty sophisticated state. And some people want to just get away. Like I moved away. I was like, I had this work in college. I had to go to college, Providence College, which is near my parents' furniture store, because I had to work in the furniture store. I didn't have a choice. And I lived at home. I couldn't even live in the basement of my house. My father said he didn't want to spend extra money on the heat. I had to live in my room that I grew up in. And when I was 22, I was like, I'm done. I'm going to law school and went to DC and then New York and all that.
Right.
But there is a part of you that still wants to be close to that place, right? Yeah. Which I'm sure you feel. And talk about that from your perspective, because I really do think that there's not just the people that move away and the people that stay, but the people that stay still want to move away, and the people that move away, part of them wants to stay.
Do you know when you know something's bad for you, but you can't quit it?
Yeah.
It's the same concept over there. Those people will tell you, I hate my life, I want to get off the street, this sucks. And then they go and stand, they never leave.
Why do you think
they don't
leave?
Down the street.
You know? Why do you think they don't leave? I think it's because the idea of something new is actually, as tough as they want to come off, is scary to them.
I think a lot of them are resigned to it. I think from what I know growing up, my aunts and uncles, for some reason, couldn't move away from Ridgewood, Queens, which is where Cypress Avenue is pretty much where it runs through. I didn't understand it. I mean, they could have all got, they did, but all through my teens, they didn't, everything was working at the diner, waitressing listening this hand to mouth. And even the people, when I went down there and sort of spoke to them, I said, you know, what are you still doing here? And it's my home. I hate it, but it's my home. And I think, you know, a lot of us at the end of the day, whether or not we want to admit it, it's still home. Queens will always be my home. Even if I moved out to Long Island and, you know, and did that, I still consider it my home. And even though it's the traffic, like you were saying, man, the traffic, I got my father. My father would drive, and I swear we'd be in the car. And it's in me now. When I get in a traffic jam, I just want to kill somebody, you know, because I can't take anymore. I can't, or if I can't find a parking spot. But then I come home. I walk around the streets. I'm still here, yeah. And I guess I just can't quit. I guess yeah. That's what it is.
Did you? What is it about the idea of dissonance and the Jekyll and Hyde quality of this that you know, you say that, you know, these characters all exhibit some redeeming and beautiful qualities despite their disregard for like common civility and stuff like that. And then you said that led me to ask myself, well, don't we all, right? And not to the extremes of these characters, but there is this sort of Jekyll and Hyde quality in all of us. Is there that quality in you, and how so, and what, why do you think that never leaves a person?
Guys like David Chase and Vince Gilligan, who did Breaking Bad, and David Chase did Sopranos. I think they brought that out so masterfully in Tony Soprano and Walter White, right? Those two guys are Jekyll and Hyde. Although maybe Soprano might be completely Hyde, but in ways he had a Jekyll side to him. I think we're all that, aren't we? We all have a light and dark to us. There are things that we portray ourselves as when we leave the house every day. And like, I'm sitting here with a suit jacket on. Once I'm done with you, man, put back on my tank top and I'm going to go run around and not care about, you know,
Put on your horns.
I'll be listening to death metal soon. Hang up. But you know, it's. I think that there's a. You know, you brought up Father John White early, and I hope when people read the book, they really. I worked really hard on that character. He's based on somebody I knew, and just the guy that's a corrupt priest is such a dissonance. You know, the guy's blessing people while he's getting drunk and trying to get laid in a neighborhood. You know what I mean? I think it's. And, you know, I find even religion, there's a lot of themes in the book. There's a religious theme that runs through it. I always say that Queens is a lot of churches, cemeteries, and railroad tracks. And I write about all those things pretty much in the book, maybe a little less on the cemeteries, but church and railroad tracks. And, you know, those are all different kind of qualities. There's good and bad in both of them. Church can be, you know, everyone goes to church to get forgiven on a Sunday after all the crap they did all week, and they're back at it again Monday, you know?
Right. That's what comes out through the book, is sort of the religious themes, which is why, you know, and they're, you know, again, a lot of that struck home for me because, you know, like my cousin is in the mob, but then so I related to Father John White and, you know, how corrupt he was, because my cousin would go to the mob and be in the mob and then go to church.
Yeah.
And I don't know if he thought, you know, he'd do confession and everything. And I don't know if he thought, well, if I do that, then this cleans everything up. And I can go back to this life.
Right. Yeah. I think that's part of the book. I mean, it's to say that we're all walking contradictions, and I don't mean that in such a disparaging way where everybody has no redeeming qualities. I mean, I just think that we need to recognize those things. I find it interesting to write about them, and not to be afraid to write about them and be honest about it. You know, you write everybody is peaches and cream, I think you're full of shit, you know? So I think you should write it as who we are.
Right, right.
Which is a little devil and an angel sitting on your shoulder.
Yeah. Do you find that when you were writing it, that it was hard to relive some of, because it, you know, it is based on your life, even though these characters are not, and they're loosely based on real people. Was it hard to kind of relive some of, because, you know, in reading the book, there's some of the characters in there you just laugh out loud funny, some of the stuff that you describe in the people, but then there's other stuff where it's intense. Was it hard for you to relive that, or was it a celebration to relive some of that?
A little bit of both. I would say there was a couple of difficult things. There's one chapter called Sons. And I think, you know, both of us being sons have strange relationships with our fathers, you know, good, bad, and different. And sometimes it's very close. And sometimes
I'm glad you brought that up, because that one, go ahead. Sorry. Yeah.
No, that's okay. A common theme between my father, who I adore, and he's a great man, and was baseball. We bonded over baseball. And there's a portion of the book I write, which was this scene where the son has passed away and the father won't accept it. And it was hard to, I got teared up writing some of that stuff, because not that I didn't go through that, but there is a part of me that thought that, you know, growing up, that baseball was the only thread between my dad and I. And it wasn't, but it felt that way because we just had sports and he'd go to work and he was working late as a cop and I didn't see him a lot and then we'd have sports. And so, you know, what if that was taken away? And, you know, a lot of it was manifested in that little story there, but there's other parts in that son's chapter where there's these complicated relationships between the father and the sons, the postman and different things. And so, yeah, that was a little difficult writing. I really loved though, the good stuff. I loved writing about the neighborhoods. It put me right back there running on these streets with the Johnny Pumps blasting and the mailboxes and the Asian fruit market. And, you know, another big thing in Queens, and you know, you don't notice this in a lot of other parts of the country, we have cable wires. I don't know why they did this in Queens. Maybe you know. They put the cable wires and telephone poles all above your head. So when you look up, there's no clear sky. You just see these black cables running across everywhere. And, you know, so I wrote them in the book because, you know, when I looked up, I almost don't see them anymore because my eyes are so trained to look beyond them. But I think people must come to this borough and say, what the hell's up? Sky.
This is like wires. It's like the 50s. It's like they couldn't figure out. Well, you know, the thing about the Suns that struck me, because my father, he put floors in for a living. So and then, you know, my parents had a little furniture. So it was always work, work, work. We all had to work in the business and he would come home and he'd be exhausted. His knees were like destroyed from being on his knees. And we would go to Red Sox games because we grew up in Providence. So you're a Mets fan and I'm a Red Sox. And let's not even talk about 86, but I mean, I can't even believe I'm having you on the show.
Lenny Dykstra wrote a blurb for my book. Did you see that?
Yeah, I saw it. It was great.
I tell you some good nail stories. He's a good guy. A little crazy now.
Yeah.
But misguided a little bit, but he's got a good heart. But anyway, I digress.
Yeah, we got to go back to that because I want to hear the stories. But like, I know what you mean about like, I think what they, our fathers were working so much that it, and now being a dad myself and you know, like there's not a lot left in the tank at the end of the day to engage. And it takes a lot to just engage and not just sit in front of the TV, which we ended up doing quite a bit. Yeah. But then we would go to baseball games and that's when, and then we'd drive back and we'd stop and get like waffles at a place called Bickford's. I could still remember it. Like it was like a tradition. And so I kind of got like a little teary eyed reading that sunshine. It was like, I got it. And then, my son and I have a close bond over baseball. He played, grew up, he's a baseball player, loves baseball. I mean, we do other things other than sports, but you know, we were just texting last night about, you know, we just traded Vasquez to the Houston Astros night they were playing the Astros.
Yeah. In the middle of the game, they told him, right? Or the end of the game.
The beginning of the game. They're interviewing him.
Yeah.
And an Astros hat, and Vasquez was like, did you know? And Vasquez is just like, and then somebody came over, and producer put, I'm not a producer, somebody who clearly worked for the Astros, put a hand on his shoulder like that, and just literally pulled him out of the scrum of photographers and reporters. Yeah. But, you know, I totally, that section totally resonated with me because you're able to, you do a nice job in the book of weaving sort of these really sweet moments with these really kind of, you know, ooh, kind of fucked up. Like, what was that? Like, what is that? Or what was that? And that's what I like, because that's the duality. That's the dissonance. That's real life. Like that's the,
isn't that what life is? It's not all, you know, mashed potatoes and gravy.
Right.
The days you're going to get some burnt chop liver and stuff, you know what I mean? And it's every, you know, every week is something new. You know, they have highs and ultra highs and there'll be lows,
right?
And so I thought the book really wanted to represent what life really is in that book. It does get kind of dark a lot, but there are light moments and funny stuff going on and little changes between some characters that made you laugh, and I wanted to make, you know, do both of those things because that's how life is, you know.
Everybody
is, you know, it's something different.
What is, why was religion such a big theme for you in this? Like, was it a big theme in your life growing up?
Yeah. You know, so I went to public school the first 4 years of my education. And then my parents, because the schools, the public schools where I lived were a little rougher, they wanted to put me in parochial because they thought I'd have a better education. I still think I should have stayed in the public schools. But yeah, you know, I went to church my whole life. I did all the sacraments. I went to parochial high school. But I found it so hypocritical. I think faith should be a personal thing. I don't think organized religion, I think we should, George Carlin said it best, they should tax the churches and abolish the damn thing. But, you know, they'd wipe out the national debt alone if they tax them on their real estate. But, you know, I think faith and spirituality should be a personal thing. I think when you get together in a church and start chanting mumbo jumbo to this guy, I think that had a real effect on me and it turned me off to religion. And so I still think about it often because, you know, you get brainwashed when you're in these schools, I believe. I don't think they mean to do it. They're told to do it. And then they all just keep doing it. It's a bad cycle. So I wanted the motif of religion to be throughout the whole book. There's some spiritual stuff in there. And I'm a big Twilight Zone fan. I don't know about you. Heroes, man. And I did a little ghost kind of like Serling-esque little thing that had something to do with spirituality. And so to me, religion was a challenge for me as I got older because I started realizing what it was, and then organized religion. And then I found my own faith and spirituality to be a more personal thing. And I tried to put that through the book too. Everybody has their own take.
In sort of thinking about religion now versus, you know, and looking back, I mean, one of the benefits, I guess, and downsides to writing something is like you bring a different perspective to it when you start writing it. And did your view of religion change as you were writing the book, or?
I feel like it validated everything I thought.
Really?
Yeah. I feel like I was right about this, you know, cause there was this corrupt preacher that I knew growing up and it was real. And, you know, we all kind of swept it under the rug, but when you look back, I'm like, that was fucked up. You know, this guy's making house calls to give sacraments, and he wasn't giving sacraments. You know what I mean? And confession in some woman's house, is that's not cool. I think it validated a lot for me, but I think, look, I think life is a growing and learning and changing, and there's room to change for me even on this. You know, this might have came out in this book, but there's other ways to write about religion too that's positive. You know, it's that's a good thing, but I think it validated for me what I grew up around, unfortunately.
Why did you decide I know the Holy Trinity and had something to do with the three parts, but I'm curious to hear a little bit more about why you decided to do it. You set it on a Sunday, morning, afternoon, and evening, and why you decided to do that and what inspired that.
Well, the one thing you missed, and this goes back to the dissonance, is each part is six chapters long. So it's 666 going on there.
Right.
So it gives you that other side. Sunday is my favorite day of the week. I think the New York City in Queens and New York City in particular, it seems like the city goes to sleep on a Sunday. You can go into Manhattan and drive, and it's a different vibe on a Sunday. So I like the setting on that. Definitely the religious connotation, a Sunday morning, Sunday afternoon, Sunday evening, going to church in the morning, that kind of thing. And then the three parts because of the Trinity. Right. I mean, that was definitely being represented there. I tried to weave that in there as sort of a subtle hint. Not everyone picked up on it. You and the only one of the persons that have asked me that question. What was the religious connotation there? What was the undertone? And that was it. That was my little subtle way of getting it in there while writing a character as well, without being overt about, you know, I went to church on a Sunday and this is how it was. And you know, I wanted to just set it on Sunday.
You talked about, walking by the cemetery a lot. And,
Think about it. You're walking past the dead. I mean, and that's going to be you one day. And I don't mean to be morbid, but it's just sometimes this is how it happened for me. I was going to work one day and I'm walking past the cemetery. And I'm like, what am I doing? I'm getting up. I'm going to get on a crowded freaking train and I'm going to go to 9 to 5. I'm going to get back home and I'm going to get up and I'm going to go eat some dinner. I'm going to watch must-see TV and I'm going to go to sleep and then I'm going to get up again and I'm going to walk by this damn cemetery and eventually I'm just going to be in the damn cemetery. What am I? And sometimes it grounds you a little, give you a little perspective you do in your life. And like I said, Queens there's so many cemeteries in Queens. It's like so much wasted land. You know?
I was thinking the same thing. My father is in, we went to see his grave. He was born in August, we went recently, and I just remember standing there and just looking as far as I could see. There were great, and I just thought, man, this would be a great place for a shopping center. You know, you know what I mean? It's just so much land overlooking like this beautiful valley. And well, you talked about like walking by the cemetery, and you say beyond that green gated fence were the dead, and there I was alive, walking to and from in that perpetual wake shower walk. train, work, lunch, work, the duality of this. You thought about the duality of this a lot during the time I was writing the book, and it inspired me to incorporate those themes into the book. So is this something that even as a kid that would sort of strike you, or is this later in life as you become more adult and have more adult perspectives on things?
Yeah, I was a pretty sensitive kid growing up. I was always into, as much as I was into my sports, I did a lot of writing and poetry, and I love music. I'm a musician. I was really, you know, everyone used to tell me I'm confused. You know, I don't know if I want to be a jock or an artist, you know, and I said, why can't I be both? You know, I didn't say why I had to do one or the other, but when you're a kid, they pigeonhole you. You're either a geek or you're the nerd or you're a sports guy. So I tried to do everything because I just like everything, you know? So yeah, I was thinking about that even at a young age. And it's weird too, Paul, and I don't know about you, but I grew up, I had two great grandmothers and all my grandparents, and a ton of great aunts and uncles on my, especially on my father's side. And I went to a lot of funerals growing up. A lot.
A lot. I know.
And my parents were like, you gotta go, you know, you can't not go. You gotta go.
And they're open casket.
I was, you know, I got sort of numb to it after a while. And that to me was kind of weird. I'm like, man, I'll go to another funeral. Maybe we'll go out to eat after, you know. Like it was,
you start to think about exactly. You're going to go to somebody's house after the wake.
Right. And,
like, I can remember being excited about going to like my Aunt Viola's house because she always had good food after wakes.
Right, right.
And I'm like,
we used to go to this place called Niederstein's. This was like this old, they don't have it in Queens anymore. It was an old, over 100-year-old restaurant that was just sit on an old Dutch farm in Queens. And every time there'd be a wake or a burial, we'd end up there. And I'd have the sauerbraten. It was fantastic. And so you look forward to that. I said, wait a minute. Why am I looking forward to any of this? I'm going someone passed away, you know? And it's so weird. Those kind of things stick with you growing up. And I think as I got older and you know, people call me, I have such a great rememberer. I could just remember these weird details, even when I was young. And so when I started thinking about different things for the book and what to weave into it, that was one of those things where I thought about just the absurdity of death and cemeteries and the whole thing. And, you know, I think that there's two ways to look at death. You could be deathly afraid of it, right? And, we got to laugh at it a little bit and know we're all going to the same place. And it kind of gives us the great equalizer. You know, we're all together going down the same road and to be good to each other. You know, that's another thing in the book. I wanted people to, one theme I hoped was that, you know, I don't see folks talking to each other anymore. I used to know my neighbors' names. I used to know their kids. I used to see them out. I don't know anybody anymore. I'll be honest. And that's sad to me. And I was hoping people would see these folks still interacting and doing stuff together and talking and talking about neighborhood things and want to do that. That's a sad thing that's gone away. You know, you don't know your neighbor anymore.
Well, I do think that part of, you know, you talk about, I was doing an off-Broadway show called Permission to Speak, which we're going to bring back now that, you know, COVID seems to be kind of a little bit more, manageable. And we had to close it down because of COVID. But the idea, the theme of the show is I bring people on stage and they tell stories from their lives. And it's not a stand-up show, but it's born out of my performing at the Late Show and my stand-up, because people's stories are incredible. And you know, this is what I love about the book is sort of, you know, these vignettes, these stories and how rich they are. And you had this sort of, I think in the way you wrote the book and what you want to do, you even talked about sort of the commonality that we do actually have in, and, you know, you said only one thing I wanted to make, palatable is whether you live in Belmore or you live in a Rust Belt state, everybody's a neighbor. This book is about people who all know each other. They all live in the same area, share small town gossip, and it's a day in the life of these folks. And that part about the Rust Belt state and all that really resonated with me because I do think that you're right, whether it's a stoop or a front porch in Pennsylvania or the stoop in my tenement house that my grandfather built in Providence, Rhode Island, it's important, not just good, but important to have a book like this because it shows that we have more in common than we think And then maybe we're not as divisive as we can be right now. I mean, obviously politically, but just socially in a lot of areas, right? And I think that in my own way, what I took from reading is sort of that too. Like there is a way that you can read this and live in Bel Air, California in a mansion and somehow connect with these stories.
Well, let's just be honest. I want everybody in the United States to buy the book. So that's why I said that. So it doesn't matter who you are. Everyone knows that. outside of that, though, you hit it on the head. You know, we're all Americans. And I don't want to sound like, you know, have the orchestrated music behind me now. Like, oh, we're all Americans.
Huh? Yeah.
You know, we are. We are Americans. And this is one country. We should all be fighting to make it better, make each other's lives better. Right. And especially the people around you. Your neighbors are, for better or worse, they're your neighbors.
Yeah.
And your family, for better or worse, is your family. And that's one of the themes in the book, despite the characters and the hardships they're going through and their vices and the different things that grip them, they still have each other and they're still around each other and they're still on Cypress Avenue. And I think that should be, especially in this day and age, and you hit the nail on the head, even politically, where we are with wherever you fall on the spectrum, it doesn't matter. We're all Americans and we're in this great country and we're lucky to be here. And I think we should focus on that a little more, you know, and share with each other's lives and learn about each other rather than just tunnel vision, you know?
Yeah. Is there, you talked about hitting a wall a couple of times, which I totally related to, like writing this thing and like how freaky that can be.
Yeah.
What do you think caused you to hit the wall in those moments? And how did you get yourself out of it?
I was on this train, man. It was just going. Like I was writing this book and it was just, and then all of a sudden, you know, I knew where I wanted to go. I knew where it was going and I didn't know how to get from, I don't want to say where it was in the book exactly, but there was just, I got to this point where I didn't know how to move the ball forward anymore. And I remember talking to somebody about it, said, I'm stuck. You know, I'm not sure where I'm going with this. And they said, well, what does your gut tell you? You know, I said, well, I really wanted to put a poem in the middle of the book or a poem somewhere in the book or something that would just give the book something.
Right.
And so, that was really what helped me, you know, just sort of playing around with structure and different things and took a break. You know, it was good. I took a few days to reset and rethink. And I got back out there. I kind of just stayed away from it and got back out and walked around Cypress Avenue and took some photos and looked at them and then all of a sudden, you know, the wheels started churning again. So, I mean, you know, when you do your material, I'm sure you get stuck too. Like, gosh, shit. And what am I doing now?
Sometimes you got to step away from it and just stop, you know, because like, I don't know. It's hard to explain, but I totally related to it. And I wanted to see how you dealt with it because it can be scary. Like, cause especially, you know, where you are in the book and, you know, you're pretty far into it and then boom, you hit this thing. And you're like, have I just spent all this time and now I've got nowhere to go with it. But like, I just was really curious about that. And then
what do you mind too? He said, just write anything and erase it. If it stinks, don't worry. You at least you did something.
Yeah.
And that kept the motor churning too.
Did you, what was it? What's it been about poetry for you? That's been, such a passion. And I know you got some great advice from Robert Creeley, and tell that story too about that one inspirational word he gave you.
Yeah, yeah. So I'm a big beat writer fan. I love Kerouac. I love Creeley, William Burroughs, Herbert Hunke, all these guys that are Bukowski. Mm-hmm. And you know, I was really blown away when Doug Brinkley wrote a blurb for my book. Doug Brinkley is a famous presidential historian, and he's also the executor of the Hunter S. Thompson estate. He compared me to Bukowski and Miller in the blurb, and Henry Miller, which is really, I don't deserve that, but very, very kind. And it really validated what I was doing and was right. So to go back to your Creeley question, I was really into poetry. I was doing live poetry readings. I still do them from the last 2 years. I haven't. But I had went to meet Creeley. He was doing, you know, he's kind of up in age, but he was still doing some reading. He was the Poet Laureate of New York. And, I sat there, I said, you know, I was sitting on all this material and I had just gotten a scholarship to college on poetry, which they don't really give out. It's a weird scholarship to get, you know, but they actually offered it and I won it. I was a half scholarship. And I said to him, I said, you know, I really want to get this published, but I don't, I feel like there's no market for it. And he just told me, onward, just stay with it, onward. Don't stop. Don't ever stop. And Paul, you know, that was 20 years ago. And 20 years later, the novel came out. And I hung out with David Amram is another hero of mine. He hung out with Kerouac. And he's a famous jazz musician and a classical composer. He too gave me that same kind of thing. Don't stop, Mike. You got this. And again, I don't want to sound like go for it, you know, Rocky Balboa stuff. But I feel like I stayed with it. And 20 years later, this book comes out. And those guys, without them giving me that guidance and caring and giving a shit enough about a young writer like myself, I don't know if I would have gone through it.
Yeah, that's a good.
I'm sure
point.
You have people who've done that for you, right?
Oh yeah, kept you going. I mean, when I was I was struggling with my decision to leave Wall Street. There's a whole story of how I fell into getting into comedy when I was doing M&A deals on Wall Street, and Jay Leno bought some of my material, and then I started living this double life, warrior comic, and like, what am I doing? And am I going to throw this all away? I've got security. I come from a blue collar family. This is what my, you know, everybody dreamed that I would do. And I'm me too. And I was freaking out, and and I couldn't figure out. I had my foot in two different boats, and the boats were kind of going like this, you know? And I remember talking to my, quite a bit with my college advisor at the time, who was this really, guy, John McGrath, who was a really cool guy. He was very sophisticated, very, very well-read, a real scholar of literature and history. And, just a Renaissance guy. One of the, when a Renaissance guy, they're not a lot of them around anymore, right. But he said to me, look, he said onward to me, but in a different way. He said, it's like you left a shore that you were familiar with and you're swimming to another shore and you're at the point in the horizon where you can't see the shore you're going to, and you can't see the shore you left. And it's very scary, but know if you keep going that way toward that new shore that you'll find it, you'll see it. And I remember that to this day, I still remember exactly how he said it. And that kind of helped me, you know, cause I think you just need that encouragement, because, you know, as when you're especially doing the creative process, as you know, you can start to doubt yourself and go like, well, just what am I doing? Am I any good? Like all that stuff, you know? Yeah. But yeah, you had some, like, killer quotes. I mean, Rocco DiSpirito.
Yep. He's one of my buddies. Worked with him for a while, and great guy.
Yeah.
Great song.
Yeah, I didn't know that you guys worked together on...
You bring up Wall Street. No, I produced Jim Cramer's show for a while.
Did you really?
Yes, and I don't usually tell the story because, this maybe I'm breaking this. Jim, I don't know if Jim's ever even spoken about it. I helped create the Booyah thing for his thing. So he was the brains. There was no way I was going to tell Jim Cramer anything about Wall Street, right? He's up at 4 a.m, 3 a.m, looking at the numbers all morning long, the European models and whatever's happening here. And so he said, how could we make this more palatable to younger people? How do I make investing fun? Right. I said, well, why don't we, when one of your listeners has a great stock trade, say, Jim, booyah, I just made, whatever on this stock. And he said, that's great, man. And all of a sudden, everybody started doing it. Right. So yeah, I've had guys like that and Rocco. And I should have hit Jim up for a quote, man. What the hell was I thinking? Rocco and Ellie Honig and... who's great, a CNN legal analyst.
Mark I know. I've had Ellie on this show. Yeah, good guy. How do you know Ellie?
I work with him in the business.
Okay.
And he's a big Phillies fan, so I'm always ragging on him.
Yeah. Rocco says brilliant storytelling, creative genius, as fresh as memory as my first day of school. Really related to it. And then Lenny Dykstra gives you a nice little. It's so cool that I was like. I spent 5 seasons in Queens, New York, prowling center field, Shea Stadium. Mike captures the heartbeat of New York City, better than any book I know. How do you know him, and like, what is he like?
First of all, like, could you imagine? I worshipped Lenny Dykstra, right?
Yeah.
No, Strawberry was my favorite player, but Lenny, everybody loved Lenny, right? And I was a kid. I was about 8 or 9 years old when they won in 86. So going back to Cramer, I get this email that says Lenny Dykstra wants to be on with Jim Cramer. I said, yeah, bullshit. Lenny Dykstra, because everyone knows I'm a Met fan. Yeah, all right, yeah, tell Lenny to call me. And then all of a sudden, my phone rings from this San Diego area code.
Right.
Pick up the phone. It's like, hey, is this Fig? I'm like, yeah.
Says he calls you Fig. You never met him before.
Oh yeah, yeah. Because I, you know, he's just that kind of guy. You know, he's like,
that's
hey
hilarious.
Man, Lenny Dykstra, what's up, man? How you doing, dude? He's like talking like that, and I'm like, come on, yeah, I want to meet Mr. Kramer. And he was into investing for a while, believe it or not. Really? There's a whole story in that you can look into. But he really got into stocks, and then I started having him on the show with Kramer, and then all of a sudden Lenny would call me. At first it was like I'd be at a party, my phone ring. Like, oh, sorry guys. Lenny Dykstra's calling me. Just give me a minute. Yeah. Hey, Lenny, what's up? And he was one of these guys who likes to talk on the phone.
So, oh, really? That's funny. He seems like a real like guys guy who would like want to be off the phone in like a minute.
No. But I think he's trying to get the story out. But you can't cut him off. He's like, you know, man. So I was thinking, dude, you know, it's like it never gets anywhere, you know, but you know, I love the guy. And I'm like, okay, man, what's up? So then, you know, he would start, I'd go out with him. And I met David Wright coming up and all these guys with Len. Len's such a good guy. One time I was at a Mets game and Jim Duquette was the general manager. And I was with my dad and my girlfriend at the time, my brother. And all of a sudden these guys come like, you Mike Figliola? I'm like, yeah. He goes, Mr. Duquette wants to put you in his seats. I said, what? He goes, yeah, Lenny Dykstra called. He's just that kind of guy, you know? And wow. I was so blessed when I said, Lenny, would you consider doing something for the book? He goes, sure, man. Tell me what to say. I'm like, no, I can't tell you what to say. You got to tell me. He goes, all right, I got it. And that's what he came up with. It couldn't have been any better than that. Yeah, it's a dream come true for me. As a lifelong Mets fan, to have something like that.
He's like such a character. He reminds, like, I always, you know, Red Sox fan, but I remember thinking he'd be a perfect Red Sox, like real kind of blue collar,
hard nosed,
you know, kind of like there was just something about him. Did you get to hang with him a lot?
Yes. Yeah.
And so is he
good times? Great times. You know, he's a partier, likes to have a lot of fun, but he'll do anything for you. Give you the shirt off his back. I mean, the guy's just like that, you know, and you know, through him, I, you know, got to do a lot of fun stuff, really met a lot of Mets guys, players, and a lot of insight in baseball. You would tell me some stuff
that I can't reveal on here. When we're not, I was going to say, when we're not on air, you got to tell me, because I can I could tell you're pulling your punches, but I want to know, I want fun, but I won't put you on the spot. But did you think that, so is there more to tap into here in terms of, now that you've started to peel this onion back of, you know, the neighborhood and all of that, are there more places you want to go with this?
Yeah. I appreciate you asking that, because that leads right into my next book, which I just completed. What I'm really looking to do ultimately is get this first book into a TV or a streamer or somebody, really, because I think it's worth
it. Totally. I was going to ask you that next, because it just feels so, I just finished watching The Offer, you know, the 10-part series about the making of the, and it's, I thought it was well done. And I just feels, I'd rather see this as a streamer than something broken up by commercials, or I don't think a feature film gives it justification. I think there's too much here.
Yeah.
You know?
Thank you for saying that. Yeah, I agree. So I'm looking to do that with the first book, but yes, my next book explored Ridgewood, Queens on Cypress Avenue, basically the whole Cypress Avenue. The next book I'm writing about is not in vignette form. It's linear. It's written from one person's perspective in Woodhaven, Queens. Now, Woodhaven is a very old part of Queens. It was there for a long time. If you go down Woodhaven Boulevard, it turns into Cross Bay, which you probably went to Howard Beach, if you, you know, any of those areas. This is where I'm writing about now. And very similar in story of same kind of people, just a different vantage point of one guy who, to break it real quick, a synopsis would be he wakes up one day and decides that, you know, he wants to go down memory lane one more time, give it all one hurrah. I think we've all been there, right? Where we like, let me go visit my old friends and go hang out my old haunts. And then you get there. He actually makes the decision to do it. And you're like, man, this is not the way I remember it. I got to get the F out of here. You know?
Right.
So it explores that sort of relationships again, real people, blue collar people, people who are struggling, people who have to make decisions, light and dark, in another Queen setting.
Right. And do you feel, I mean, I don't know. Do you feel like there's a lot you can tap into there? Or do you feel like, I mean, obviously you've written the book, but what is it about those areas, that area that, drawing you to that subject matter. So in those characters,
that area I'm writing about is a little bit later in my life. I was sort of in my 20s mm-hmm. when I experienced all the stuff in this book, mm-hmm. The new book that I'm writing about.
Right.
And one of these scenes I write about is a biker bar that's no longer there. Mm-hmm. If I told you about this, it's the craziest thing to think that this exists. It's almost like you remember the movie Pee Wee's Big Adventure. You know, when he walks into that like house and there's like all these like whatever, it's like a little bar. These Hell's Angels are in there. Yeah. There's a place that exists in Queens. It existed in Queens that was like that. I went down this nondescript street with a friend of mine. So I'm going to show you something. You can't bring anyone else here. I thought I was going to get killed. I get to this place. It's a door with motorcycle handlebars as the door.
Right.
And there's a porta potty outside. So we go into the place and it's a garage that turns into with all these bikers in there. Right. And I met some wild people in there. It was crazy. What do you got? A patch? What do you got? A cut over there?
No.
Oh, I thought you were going to put on your biker cut.
No, I got something I wanted to read to you, but go ahead.
Yeah. And so I wanted to explore that moment in my 20s, because I write from that vantage point of this guy that really wants to run away from it all and try his old life again. And there's some different stories in there, different aspects of Queens. It's not as heavy as the Midnight on Cypress Avenue. There's not a lot of religious theme in it. It's really more about the people of this Woodhaven area. And wanting to relive yesteryear and then realizing, you know, once you romanticize it, once you get there, it's not what you thought it was.
And do you feel like, who would you center the current book around? Who would you center the if you did a streamer, center it around the priest? I mean, because it's just such a conflicted character. Who would you, I don't know if you've even thought about that.
Did you write the first book, the Slow Midnight book?
Yeah. The Slow Midnight book. Yeah.
I think the main character in that book is Sam Jean, the guy you meet at the beginning, the old guy, he's sort of like the voice that's sort of throughout the book. He has a lot of time in the book.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it would be, you'd see a lot of him in the streamer. And so it would be, you know, he's sort of the mayor of the town, you know, he's like this guy that knows everything but doesn't want to be bothered, pretends he doesn't want to be bothered with anybody, but meanwhile is involved in everything, you know? I think it would be he and I think Desi. I think she's another very important part of that book. It's sort of the old and the young and that dissonance again, you know, the one on their way out and the one on their way up. And both of them are trying to figure out how to get there.
Yeah, those make sense to me. And I think, well, you know, the whole thing, there's so much there that you feel like, it's almost like an embarrassment of riches. Like the other thing is, I mean, it sounds like your neighborhood, I mean, it was predominantly Italians and Irish. Is that fair to say?
That's my family, predominantly Italians and Irish. But I mean, if you look in that neighborhood, it's Germans, Poles, Italians, Irish. Serbian, there's a lot of mix of people, Jewish, everybody's there. It's a real melting pot, but that's what Queens is, you know. Really, and you know what's funny, the neighborhoods change, Paul. Like they go through cycles, you know. All of a sudden there'll be a rich population of Hispanics in there, right? And then they'll move out to another part, and then the Germans will come in, you know what I mean? And then you have some holdouts who stay and they don't leave, and then you know it becomes this really weird mixing. Melting pot of people. It was a mix of everybody. And we were a bunch of mutts. I mean, that's really what we were, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
White, black, Hispanic, everybody. You know,
everybody. See, my neighborhood was different in that way because it was pretty much all Italians, maybe a couple of Irish, but there was still, you know, and the other thing you mentioned too is you talk about the buildings and wanting that the streets and the apartment are very much alive. They're like people in many ways.
Yeah.
So good. They're not just structures. Explain to people what you mean by that.
The building, the apartment buildings and the infrastructure on Cypress Avenue is as much alive as the guy walking down the street coming back from the bodega. And a bodega, just so your audience knows who doesn't know, then you have a national audience here. That's like a convenience store, a deli.
Right.
So, you know, they have some kind of the same kind of personality, the same kind of duality. Some are beautiful, some are You know, there's a lot of it too, Paul. It's a historic district in Cypress Avenue. It's all like some of it's been deemed a historic district by the city, and it's dilapidated. You know, I mean, it's all run down. It's wild. It's just another dichotomy where it's this weird dissonance of, you know, this beautiful old infrastructure that's been run down. One of the things that grabbed me too, real quick, about the infrastructure and the buildings, what really the first idea I had, not just to write about the people, when you walk down the streets of Cypress Avenue or even the sidewalks, all of the windows are shut. A lot of them are shut. And I always wondered what was going on behind those windows. Everyone, right? I mean, it's got to be millions, like you said, it's millions of stories. Like you said, you bring up your show you were doing. You bring somebody up and they have all these fascinating stories and their lives are linked to all these other people.
Right.
So the building to me was the housing, where we all was housed, and then behind it were all these stories. So yeah, if you ever take a ride down there, I think you'll see what I mean. It's each building has its own personality, and it's very much a character in the book.
But how did you think to like to even like, to me that's so creative, like how did you think to even sort of give those places life? Like that's, to me, explain that.
So we'll go back to the poetry. The title, The Slow Men on Cypress Avenue, was a poem.
Yeah.
And the poem was, I like to write the titles of everything first, and then I write afterwards. I have an idea. I come up with this. I try to make an epic title. And then I'll write the stuff. I like to write in my poems. I write a lot of narrative poetry where about stories about people, you know, Betty came down the stairs off the stoop and found her way to the bar. And then when she got there, it's like this rhythmic thing. And somebody said to me, listen, Fig, if you don't turn The Slow Man on Cypress Avenue into a novel, I'm going to do it. The title's too good.
Yeah, because you talk about you were in this writer's group and you were sharing poems, and this started as a poem. And this other writer said, and that's a classic, like, talk about kicking you in the ass. Like, now you're like,
you had the shit out of me, man. Yeah, I said, I better get on this thing because I think he was serious. I don't think he was joking around. So, yeah, that's how it was born. And then I said, you know, wouldn't it be cool to immortalize and write this love letter to this part of my life that I just find so dear and unique. You know, it's a unique experience. Nobody writes about Cypress Avenue or Queens like that.
Right.
You know, we have Louis Armstrong, we have some other folks who write about these things, but you know, musically, and you know, I wanted to capture that.
Do you mind? There's several passages I'd love to read from this just for people, but there's something just so people get a sense of just how beautiful the writing is, if you don't mind. This is Mr. Jean, and you talk about, you know, those days I was able to share such things with another woman. No, Mr. Jean, or a fat Fran in a moo dress, just good old Samuel Jean. Friends called me Sam or Snap when we were playing pool in the halls that dotted the many miles that Myrtle Avenue spanned from Brooklyn to Queens. The pool hall would be filled with guys looking for a fight or just looking to lay down a few bucks for a cream soda and a low wager. I love cream soda. And I would greet them both. Here's how it would go down. I would stand at the foot of the table, sip the cream soda and scotch, and slam down a few bills, match my good eye up to the green felt, and aim my lucky stick at that white hot cue ball. The boys watched, girls watched. The barkeep counted the days, keep with one eye and watched me out of his other. Outside, there's like such a great rhythm to this. Outside, the rain would be washing down, cooling the summer streets and streaking across the front glass of the pool hall. Juke roared, Harlem-born jazz and bop and a never-ending loop. And at the other end of the table would stand the red-haired, big-bosomed baby, big, staring straight at me with an Alice Cramden smile. God, there's so many great. It was Goldie Samuels. She never wavered, just watched and waited for that cue ball to deliver a devastating blow to the boys' hopes on the table. She knew it would happen. She let them know by paying them no mind and waiting for me, for my moment to sink that last striped billiard ball in the corner pocket, take the pot of cash, then deliver a dinner of steak, mash, and plenty of beer. The boys would yell, come on, snap, snap. You ain't got this time, Snap. You ain't got it this time. But that's the last sound anyone would ever hear until my ball fired off the end of my cue stick and smacked straight into the others already deposited in that pocket. After a few handshakes, victory marches, and cocktails, we mad dashed through the rain back to her apartment, a railroad on the edge of Fresh Pond Road in Myrtle, and crashed into her unmade Murphy bed. Of course, it's a Murphy bed. It's got to be. Great. But before the broad stroke of lovemaking that night, she'd stand up and fling wide open the window that faced the street, and the rain-borne breeze would blow her hair and the soft drapes in her Betty Page dress everywhere. We never did care. I mean, that's just incredible. This is great. Yeah.
Thank you so much.
I felt like I was in that pool hall, you know what I mean? And I flagged a bunch of these moments in the book where you're just like, you could tell you lived this.
Yeah.
You could tell you lived this because it's detail woven upon detail, woven upon detail in a way that's, if you were just an observer, even did your quote unquote good writer's research, you couldn't, you know, you just couldn't, you couldn't convey the sense of the smell of the place, you know?
That's super kind of you. I've been in those bars. I played pool. I'm a little too young for a Murphy bed. That was just a writer's choice that I made, but I've been in that room too, with that sort of excitement after a night and the window.
But that's that Murphy bed, it's two words, but that, like, yeah, it would be fine without it, but it's better with it. And it only could be a Murphy bed.
It only could be.
In a railroad flat.
In a railroad flat.
Like, what else, right? Like, I mean, that's what, at that level, that socioeconomic status, like, that's what that, it's just, and it's throughout the book. And I really, you know, I just want people to get the book and read the damn thing, because if you never have to step foot in Queens or know New York or anything, but you're really great at just bring you right in. I mean, it was a little easier for me because I just felt like you were kind of writing about my neighborhood and my life in a way. Mm-hmm. So probably a little easier for me to connect with it, but the writing is so really detailed and beautiful and brilliant that it's going to bring people in.
I really love painting pictures with words. That's just my thing. Well, maybe it's my poetry background, but when I write that kind of stuff, Paul, I almost go into a trance, and it's playing in my mind as I'm just going.
Yeah.
I type and type and type and type, and I'm remembering and adding, and it's just, that's how it goes for me. But yeah, a lot of those things are based on moments I've had. Yeah.
Is it De Niro goes, you have a gift. You have the gift, my friend. I can't remember what scene from the movie it's from, but, I just, you know, listen, other than the fact that you're a Mets fan, by the way, your Mets are so good.
You know, my
Red Sox are so terrible. Look at my Red Sox. We're like rebuilding. I don't even know what we're doing.
You've had so many good years. You've had all these wins. You have the freaking Tom Brady. You have everybody.
Wait a minute. You can't start bringing in other sports now. That's cheap.
Fucking Celtics, everybody. Come on.
I was at game 7 in 86, the one where we, you know, ultimately, you know, I wasn't at the, I was shit. In an apartment.
Oh.
I was in an apartment with a bunch of Red Sox fans in game 6 when the ball went through Buckner's leg.
I can't even imagine.
And you know, we were young, but we had like, you know, booze or whatever, and somebody had a champagne bottle, and they literally had like the foil off, and then somebody was like, put it away. And it was just, and then somebody had tickets to game 7. And you know, that didn't happen, and it was a mess, but yeah, it was, God,
it still hurts.
I can't watch the Buckner thing. I cannot watch.
What was he doing out there?
Listen, it was Calvin Schiraldi's fault.
Him that too. Kid, another idiot.
You're right. He shouldn't have been out there.
Right.
But Schiraldi, you could tell when he was given the ball, he wanted nothing to do with that moment. Like he just had that, really dry mouth, cat mouth. It's like, and you could tell he just wasn't ready for the moment. He was young, whatever. And then, you know, if he only had to get, I think, one out. I think, if I'm remembering correctly.
Yeah. It was one out. That's all you
needed.
Batman had popped out. Hernandez had flied out. And then we got all these little.
Look at you knowing every stinking detail, because it was your.
I love watching Bill Burr get pissed off about that. What the
hell? Yeah, it just, it's like, yeah, it's like, but you guys are good now. I mean, you got Lindor and,
oh man, finally. Man,
oh my God. And then you got Max Scherzer, like that guy's a machine.
Oh, well, you know, let me tell you though, a hot dog costs about $35 now because of him. So, which, look, I'll trade it. It's all working.
You know? So I read some stat that Fenway Park is the most expensive ticket right now in terms of four tickets, hot dogs, drinks for your kids, whatever.
Yeah.
More than Yankees. And I think it's Yankees, Mets, second, third after that. But, but anyway, all right, listen. Everybody needs to go buy this book. All right. It's very important to me.
Thank you.
It's The Slow Midnight on Cypress Avenue. It's Fig. it's so funny calling you Fig. And so when is the next book coming out before we end this? Do we know?
I'm working on it. Like my agent did the book with this one. I'm eternally grateful to him. He has a full plate of folks. So I'm looking for a new agent now to get the book into the right home and to help me develop the first one into a movie. So it's done. I have a few leads, a few irons in the fire, but nothing yet. So I'm hoping by early next year that can happen. I was really hoping by the summer. It didn't work out that way yet, but I want the right fit. And I really have learned to take my time with this and not to rush it and get into the wrong hands or just make a deal to make a deal.
Yeah.
So yeah, hopefully next year, but the book's done. I've gotten some good feedback on it and hopefully next year. Yeah.
Good. Well, we'll talk about that too. And then I want to see this first book get made into a streamer. That's going to be I'm going to go to church and pray a lot.
You don't mount to God's ears, man. On Cypress.
Mike Figliola, the book is The Slow Midnight on Cypress Avenue. A fantastic book. Check it out. Read it. It's terrific. And we'll get you back and we'll do the second book and we'll talk about that.
Love you, old friend. Thank you so much.
There you go. Mike Figliola, terrific guy, terrific author. Get the book and come check me out this week, Plano, Texas, August 18th to the 20th, House of Comedy, and the following week, August 25th to the 27th, also the House of Comedy in Phoenix, Arizona. All right, guys, thank you. Hope you enjoyed the show. See you next week.